American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
The sound of hooves. That's what they've been dreading for days. Every time it came, it meant death was near. Another Black Rider. Another moment to hold your breath and hope the shadow passed. But this time, another sound accompanies the hooves. The twinkling of bells. And when the rider appears, he doesn't bring dread. He brings light. White horse, golden hair. A presence so radiant it pierces the fear like morning sunlight. Frodo and others don't know it yet, but they have just met one of the most quietly powerful figures in all of Middle-earth. A warrior of the First Age. A legend who has already died once and returned. I'm Aaron, and this is Lore of the Rings. Today is part 3 of 4, exploring the chapter Flight to the Ford from J.R.R. Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring. Download the chapter guide for this chapter at ringspodcast.com/flight. Now, let's wander. There's a moment tucked into the chaos of Flight to the Ford that I think gets easily overlooked, eclipsed by the urgency of Black Riders, the majesty of Glorfindel, and the sheer danger Frodo finds himself in. But this moment is worth pausing for, because it tells us something profound about Samwise Gamgee. He sings. Now, this alone might seem like a simple thing. Hobbits, after all, are prone to songs. Songs of meals, of bath time, of old walking tunes and tavern tales. But this particular moment catches me. Frodo is wounded. They are being hunted. They've just stumbled upon 3 stone trolls in a clearing. The very same that Bilbo and the dwarves encountered all those years ago. It's eerie, and it's certainly not safe. And Sam breaks into a song. But not just any song, but a poem he composed himself, apparently, about a troll gnawing on a bone. In this strange moment of tension and uncertainty, Sam doesn't reach for a sword or even courage, exactly. He reaches for story. He reaches for humor. For imagination. The narration gives us a little insight into Sam's mind. When Frodo asks him about the song, Sam says, quote, "These old images here brought it to my mind." Images, he calls them. Not statues, not trolls, not even monsters. Images. And that word, that choice of language, I think is deeply revealing. Images is a word rich with meaning, especially in Tolkien's own lexicon. In his brilliant essay on fairy stories, Tolkien writes, quote, "The human mind is capable of forming mental images of things not actually present. The faculty of conceiving the images is, or was, naturally called imagination." Sam is often underestimated by readers and by other characters, even by Frodo himself. But here we get a glimpse of the secret wellspring of his strength. He has imagination, not just in the sense of whimsy or play, but in the deeply Tolkienian sense, the ability to form mental images of things not present, to weave stories out of the world, to see past the immediate and into something older, richer, and stranger. We've seen this in Sam before, of course. He's the one most entranced by Bilbo's stories. While Merry is too practical and Pippin too skeptical, Sam believes. Elves walking starlit paths, trolls turned to stone, dragons and dwarves and forgotten songs. Sam drinks it all in. And here, as they find the stone trolls, it's Sam who connects their present danger to a larger story. He's the one who responds not with dread, but with a burst of creativity. Now, I wouldn't call this poem high art, exactly. And Tolkien doesn't pretend that it is. In fact, it's just sophisticated enough to feel like something Sam would compose. The rhyme scheme is A-A-B-C-C-A-C, a little more complex than it needs to be, slightly off-kilter and full of playful rhythm. It's a comic song, and the meter adds to the humor. The troll munches and mumbles, the unfortunate victim wishes the troll had left him alone. It's part folktale, part dark comedy, and 100% Samwise Gamgee. But what I really love is how Tolkien uses this moment to showcase his own craftsmanship. Because in the middle of this beautifully written chapter, full of tension and prose that flows like music, we suddenly get a jester's rhyme. But it's not just Tolkien's voice, exactly, it's Sam's. The poem is meant to sound like Sam. It's a kind of literary ventriloquism that shows just how masterful Tolkien really was. He could write a poem that fits this beautiful and majestic world, sure, but he could also write a poem that fits a character, and in doing so, deepen that character with just a few stanzas. Compare Sam's poem, just for fun, to another poem we've encountered earlier in the book. Strider's telling of Luthien's song in the chapter A Knife in the Dark is something else entirely. Just listen to the difference. Quote, "The leaves were long, the grass was green, the hemlock umbels tall and fair, and in the glade a light was seen of stars in shadow shimmering." And now Sam's poem. Quote, "Troll sat alone on his seat of stone and munched and mumbled a bare old bone." One poem sings with elvish grace, echoing ancient tragedy and starry beauty. The other is a fireside tale, earthy and humorous. And yet both are true in their own way. Both have their place in the tapestry of Middle-earth. That Tolkien could weave them both into his narrative, side by side, shows the incredible breadth of tone and texture in his work. He wasn't just writing an epic, he was building a world where songs as high and as low as these could coexist. Frodo's response to Sam's song is this, quote, "I am learning a lot about Sam Gamgee on this journey. First he was a conspirator, now he's a jester. He'll end up becoming a wizard or a warrior." It's such a warm moment, and on first read you might pass it by with a chuckle. But Frodo's offhand remark is actually quite prescient, because of course Sam will become something close to both. A warrior, certainly, though he'd deny it. A wizard, not in robes and staves and fireballs, but in the deeper magic of endurance, compassion, and hope. And that hope, I think, is rooted in his imagination, in his belief in stories, in his ability to laugh and sing, even in the darkness. And Sam's response to Frodo is telling, quote, "I hope not," he says. "I don't want to be neither." It is so honest, so humble. Sam doesn't want greatness. He's not chasing power. He isn't trying to become a hero. He just wants to see elves and help Frodo and go home again to his garden. That simplicity, that contentment, is part of his strength. Because in a world where everyone is grasping for something, rings, kingdoms, vengeance, legacy, Sam wants none of it. He is faithful, he is grounded, and he is content with the beauty of the world as it is. And perhaps that is why he is so resistant to the corrupting power of the ring. He doesn't desire to dominate. His imagination is not turned toward conquest, but toward simple and silly scenes, toward remembering stories and telling new ones. So in this small moment, with a silly troll song and a laugh from Frodo, we've learned something truly foundational about Sam. He is more than what he seems, and he will continue to surprise us again and again as this journey unfolds. If you've been enjoying this episode, and especially this reflection on Samwise Gamgee, consider sharing it with a friend. Just like Sam is a faithful companion to Frodo, maybe you can be the friend who brings someone else along for the journey into Middle-earth. After all, a good story is meant to be shared, and Sam would surely agree with that. If you've been following along in The Fellowship of the Ring, you'll notice something clever Tolkien is doing. Frodo's path, at least early on, mirrors Bilbo's. It's not exact, but it rhymes. The locations are familiar. Some dangers echo earlier ones. The mentors are overlapping, and at this moment in Flight to the Ford, we get what I believe is the final clear resonance between Bilbo's journey and Frodo's, before the two begin to diverge completely. It's a kind of farewell to the familiar. The company is walking down through the woods in the afternoon, and it's noted that they're, quote, "probably following the very track that Gandalf, Bilbo, and the dwarves had used many years before." There's something kind of lovely about that line, probably. There's no map in front of them, no GPS signal pinging off satellites, just memory, story, and instinct. They're retracing the steps of old adventure. And that is where they find a stone in the grass, quote, "A troll's hoard, perhaps? No, not quite. This stone bears dwarf runes and secret marks. Merry is the one to recognize what it must be. This is the place where Bilbo and the dwarves buried the gold they found in the troll's cave back in The Hobbit." Now, this is an incredible callback. one that's not just about continuity or Easter eggs, Tolkien is doing something more textured here. He's physically placing Frodo on the same path at the same landmarks as Bilbo. And in doing so, he's preparing us for the split, because this is the last time Frodo will share Bilbo's road in any real sense. From here on, the echoes will fade, and Frodo's journey will become far darker, far more burdened, and far more his own. But let's pause for a second on this image, a treasure buried in the grass, marked by runes that only a few can read. In The Hobbit, after the trolls are turned to stone and their cave is discovered, Bilbo and the dwarves carry out pots of gold and treasure. They bury it, not far from the track, near the river, quote, very secretly, and with, quote, a great many spells over them. The image is almost mythic. It's what you'd expect in a fairy tale. Treasure, hidden under spell and stone, waiting for the lucky or the worthy to rediscover it. And when Merry wonders aloud how much of it Bilbo ever recovered, Frodo lets slip the simple, profound truth, quote, none. Bilbo gave it all away. Think about that for a moment. Bilbo, who once clutched a small ring to his chest in Gollum's cave, who once risked life and limb for dragon-hoarded gold, gave away his treasure. There's a whole character arc in that one line. Bilbo has changed. By the time of the Fellowship, he has been transformed, not by what he gained, but by what he let go of. And I think that line, Bilbo gave it all away, hangs like a quiet bell over the scene. And that's why this feels to me like a parting point of their stories. The treasure in the ground is the last touch point between their two stories, a tangible reminder of Bilbo's journey, left behind like a breadcrumb on the trail. And Frodo, in passing it, moves on. It's a moment that says, that was Bilbo's adventure. This is yours. But I imagine that being here, in this place where Bilbo once stood, facing the same trees, walking the same trail, maybe even catching some lingering memory of old campfires and songs, must have been an encouragement to Frodo. A moment of continuity, a sign that he's not entirely alone in this wild, wide world, that others have walked before him and somehow made it through. It's a contrast to what Frodo carries now. The ring isn't buried. It's very much above ground, and it's dragging its bearer into the very heart of darkness. Frodo can't afford to bury his burden. He must carry it, and he must be changed by it. And so, in this brief pause in the woods, Tolkien gives us the hinge of transition. One final homage to the Hobbit, a last playful glance over the shoulder, before we press forward into uncharted territory. And of course, as readers, we know what comes next. This cozy sense of déjà vu is about to be shattered by something new, something bright and ancient and powerful. Because on the road ahead, awaiting around the bend, is not another dwarf or dragon or goblin. No, the next character Frodo will meet is something entirely different. An elf. But not just any elf. An elf who shines.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The sound that has haunted Frodo since he left the Shire returns. Hoofbeats. That unmistakable rhythm of dread. In The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien doesn't just describe danger. He sounds it. The Nazgul come not with a trumpet or war cry, but with the ordinary, everyday sound of a horse on a road. That's part of the terror. They wear the disguise of normalcy and twist it into something paralyzing. So when hoofbeats echo again in flight to the ford, we, like the hobbits, are bracing ourselves. We're expecting the worst. But this time, Tolkien gives us a clue that something is different. The hoofbeats are accompanied by a sound that would never follow a ringwraith, the tinkling of bells. It's a detail that would almost be comical in any other context. Bells? On a horse? But here, that delicate sound becomes a signal, a herald of hope. In a character that has been shadowed by black riders and cold fear, these bells are music from a different world. Only one in the company understands what this means. Strider sees it first, not just with his eyes, but with something deeper. The text tells us that he had, quote, a look of joy on his face, Strider, who has seen more of the enemy than perhaps any of the hobbits can guess, knows that this is not a threat. Quote, "His horse was white, and he seemed to shine in the dusk like a star come down from the heavens." Everything about this figure stands in contrast to the Nazgul. Where they are cloaked in shadow and void, this rider is light and clarity. His steed glows white, his hair is golden, his garments sparkle with gems, quote, "like living stars." And most striking of all, quote, "to Frodo it appeared that a white light was shining through the form and raiment of the rider." Tolkien's not just telling us that this elf is good, he is communicating it through imagery that radiates power, sanctity, and purity. This is someone who doesn't just fight the darkness. He is the opposite of it. And even though Frodo is the one most deeply affected by the ring, even though he's on the edge of unconsciousness from his wound, he knows this rider is good. There's something deeply telling in that. Frodo, whose perception has been clouded by the Nazgul blade and the ring itself, still senses the purity of this elf. And this elf, of course, is Glorfindel. Now, if you're coming to the books from the movies, this may come as a surprise, because in Peter Jackson's adaptation, it's Arwen who rides out to meet Aragorn and the hobbits, not Glorfindel. And that's understandable. There are practical reasons to consolidate characters in the film. But something big is lost in the trade, because Glorfindel isn't just another elf. He's one of the oldest and most powerful elves we meet in The Lord of the Rings. And the way Tolkien introduces him here is actually understated compared to what he represents in the deeper Legendarium. Strider, for instance, says simply that Glorfindel, quote, "dwells in the house of Elrond." That's technically true, but that's like saying Gandalf likes to smoke his pipe. It's accurate, but not the whole story. So who is Glorfindel? Well, if we pull back and look into the First Age, yes, the First Age of Middle-earth, we find Glorfindel at the fall of Gondolin. He's a warrior, a noble of the elves of the House of the Golden Flower. And in the city's final hours, he performs an act of stunning bravery. He fights a Balrog on a mountain pass to allow refugees to escape. He defeats the creature, but is pulled down with it, falling to his death. Quote, "then dreadful was their plight, and hardly would they have been saved by the valor of yellow-haired Glorfindel, chief of the House of the Golden Flower of Gondolin. Many are the songs that have been sung of the duel of Glorfindel and the Balrog upon a pinnacle of rock in that high place, and both fell to ruin in the abyss. Except not forever." Because sometime between the end of the First Age and the narrative of The Lord of the Rings, Glorfindel returns. Tolkien's writings in the history of Middle-earth and in the nature of Middle-earth and other essays explain that certain elves who die in great service can be re-embodied, that is, brought back from the halls of Mondos. And Glorfindel is one of the few examples we have of this. Now, the question of elvish reincarnation gets complicated. The body is dead and can't be brought back to life, but the elf's spirit could be given a new body, either through birth or by the Valar, the powers that govern Middle-earth, creating a new and perfect replica. But it gets complicated. What about parents, or a spouse if the elf was married? Should elves be allowed to go back to Middle-earth if they are rehoused in a body? What would it be like to stand in a new body looking at the place where your first body was buried? Frankly, Tolkien never fully resolved these ideas. It's one of those mysteries that doesn't have a clear answer. All we can accept is that Glorfindel died in the First Age, and at some point, was sent back with a new body. So the elf we meet on the road to Rivendell isn't just a powerful warrior or a high noble of Elrond's house. He's someone who has died and returned. He has seen the uttermost west, he has stood before the Valar, and he has come back. Not to rule or to dominate, but to guide, to protect, to resist the shadow. And that's why the Nazgul can't stand before him. There's this fantastic bit of subtle foreshadowing in how Glorfindel first appears. He doesn't attack, he doesn't throw down a challenge, he just rides up, senses the danger, and knows. Even the first words he speaks carry a kind of resonance. Quote, "I nai vidui dunadan, magovanyan." Now, Tolkien doesn't give us a translation of this phrase in the main text, and that's interesting, because he loved to share his languages. He practically built Middle-earth as a playground for philology. So why no translation here? One theory is that we're still inside the Hobbit perspective. Perhaps Frodo doesn't understand this Elvish, so neither do we. That seems rather unlikely. Another possibility is that the phrase is considered so familiar in-universe that it needs no explanation, like someone saying, well met, or at last, to a friend long expected. But if you're curious, the phrase means something like, ah, at last, Dunedain, meaning Strider, well met. It's both formal and deeply heartfelt. It speaks to old alliances and long roads. Glorfindel and Strider, after all, are part of the same long war, one that spans generations and continents. And yet, Tolkien resists the urge to info dump here. He lets Glorfindel be a mystery. He allows us to feel what Frodo must feel. Awe, comfort, and the sense that help has arrived, but also that there are deeper histories moving beneath the surface of this story. There's one more thing that Glorfindel represents, and I think this is subtle but powerful. He's proof that death is not the end. He has gone beyond the world and returned. Not corrupted, not diminished, but strengthened, purified. That's not a small thing in a story that revolves around corruption and power. Glorfindel isn't just a light in the darkness. He's a light that came back from darkness, and now stands against it. But even with Glorfindel here, radiant, powerful, otherworldly, the company is still in danger. Frodo is still wounded. The Black Riders are still hunting. And the final test of this chapter, the sprint to the Ford of Bruin Inn, still lies ahead. That moment is coming, but it hasn't arrived yet. For now, we rest with the image of Glorfindel, golden-haired, shining in the dusk, speaking words of welcome, and standing like a beacon on the edge of a deepening darkness. Thank you to this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to support the Lore of the Rings podcast, visit ringspodcast.com/member. If you found today's Wandering of Middle-earth to be inspiring, please share this episode with a friend. Lastly, if you would like to connect with me, I am most active on Threads. Find a link to my profile at ringspodcast.com and tap the at symbol near the top. And thank you for wandering Middle-earth with me today.
Spreadsheets, clunky software, 100 different logins just to run your business? Ah.
There's a better way. Odoo. One simple, connected platform that handles sales, inventory, accounting, and more, so you can focus on growing, not juggling. Make the switch today at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com.